Good afternoon. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Hooten, Judge Smith, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Morning, everyone, or good afternoon, everyone. Mr. Sullivan, I cannot see you. There you are. Just want to make sure everyone's here. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is December 2nd, 2020. We have three cases on the calendar. We're here for our first matter. I'll have the marshal call the first case.
The first matter on for oral argument is court file number A200494, Dr. Kimberly Finch versus Abbott Northwestern Hospital et al.
All right, counsel, before we begin, I just ask that you mute your microphone when you are not speaking. The marshal will show the running clock of your time. Please pay attention to the amount of time that you have left. And I'd ask that you identify yourself and your client before beginning your argument for the record. Each party will have 15 minutes for their primary argument, and the appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good afternoon. Matt Pellick on behalf of appellant Kimberly Finch. And I want to thank the court and the court staff for your diligent efforts in allowing us to participate remotely. I know it's been a long year with a lot of technical issues, and so we appreciate being able to participate here and hear this important case. I want to begin by highlighting some of the key evidence from the factual record that demonstrates the district court's clear error and why reversal of the order granting summary judgment is warranted. This is a case where there is a printed document stating that Dr. Finch feared retaliation, and she sent that as a meeting agenda to meet with executives at Allina. The district court concluded that even though one of the written topics of the meeting was fear of retaliation, that this meeting did not constitute protected conduct. But
how do we know, counsel, what that was? If she wrote fear of retaliation, what's the evidence that it's retaliation for engaging in protected conduct?
Thank you,
Your
Honor.
As opposed to just retaliation for, you know, I don't know what, human resources disputes or, you know, other types of disputes other than protected conduct.
That's right, Your Honor. I'd say, first of all factual inferences are to be drawn in Dr. Finch's favor. And while there is additional direct and indirect evidence that the meeting touched on protected conduct and complaints about conduct that's prohibited by the Minnesota Human Rights Act, the mere fact that there is a printed agenda here where the topic of discussion was listed as retaliation is strong inferential evidence that this meeting was a protected activity.
But counsel, there's actually deposition testimony about what was said during that meeting. Can you talk about where in Dr. Finch's testimony where she claims that the nature of the misconduct that she apparently reported to Dr. Goring and Carruthers was about protected activity?
Yes, Your Honor. As a kind of baseline to that question, you know, what was going on at this time is Dr. Gottlieb, who was an Allina employee, was engaged in serial misconduct and harassing of interns and abusive conduct towards his colleagues. And the Minnesota Supreme Court, after the summary judgment order in this case, reinstated one of those interns' claims against Allina for alleged violations of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And so I think one of the errors of the district court here was focusing only on Dr. Finch reporting retaliation against her as one of the potential violations of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. But it's important to keep in mind, and one thing that the district court ignored, was that throughout this time, there were alleged violations of the Minnesota Human Rights Act against interns and other employees of Allina. And during Dr. Finch's deposition, and there's other evidence that she was there to discuss how her direct supervisor had mishandled those reports of misconduct. And both during her deposition, and I would point to Ms. Carruthers, one of the Allina executives at the meeting, her handwritten notes of that meeting touched on Dr. Schmitz's reactions to the reports about Dr. Gottlieb's conduct, and that Dr. Finch felt cornered, that she felt ostracized, that she was not free to raise concerns about Dr. Gottlieb's violations of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And I mean, Ms. Carruthers testified that
I didn't see that in her deposition testimony, that she said at that meeting she talked about those things.
She talked about Dr. Schmitz and his mishandling of her conduct related to Dr. Gottlieb. And I think you look no further than Ms. Carruthers' handwritten notes about that meeting, that Dr. Finch felt cornered and she felt silenced. And throughout this time, what
she felt cornered and silenced during that. She reported feeling cornered and silenced. That's what you're saying.
Yes.
Okay. And tied that to her protected conduct, because what did she say at the meeting? Not the agenda for it, but what did she say was the conduct that resulted in that?
Thank you, Your Honor. That Dr. Schmitz was acting against her because she had raised concerns about how interns were treated at Allina. And the treatment of the interns is right there also in the written topic of the meeting. And why I raised Dr. Gottlieb's conduct and the ABLE matter is the treatment of the interns is Dr. Gottlieb's violations of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And that's a matter of public record in the ABLE matter. And on a summary judgment where all facts and inferences are in Dr. Finch's favor, that's strong inferential evidence that this meeting touched on protected conduct. I would go on from the June 15th meeting to Dr. Finch's testimony that her direct supervisor told her it would be an exercise in humiliation for her to apply for the training director position. Dr. Finch's testimony on this matter is direct evidence of retaliation, because she testifies that her supervisor told her, number one, do not apply, you would embarrass yourself. And number two, that the reason you would embarrass yourself is that executives at Allina do not have a favorable impression of you based on your protected conduct. Obviously, he didn't use the phrase protected conduct, but he was referring to her ongoing efforts to highlight the mistreatment of interns at Allina. Now, the district court—
Can you tell me, counsel, I didn't see it in there, and maybe it's not, but when did that conversation occur? Is that pinpointed in the record?
It's not pinpointed. Okay. Dr. Finch testified that it was within a few weeks of when she would be applying. And so it was sometime in the later summer of 2016. But there's not an exact date of that. But she recalled that it was within a few weeks of when the application period was opening for that position. And Dr. Finch testified that Dr. Schmitz told her it would be an exercise in humiliation. The district court simply discounted that entire testimony and said that Dr. Finch had not produced substantial evidence that she was ever told this. But Dr. Finch's testimony is evidence, and it is credited and treated as true for purposes of a summary judgment motion. And so the district court simply weighing in here and making a credibility determination about Dr. Finch's testimony is one aspect of the clear error here. And the third aspect is, again, a written communication from the director of Allina Human Resources, Kimberly Drennan, accusing Dr. Finch of quote unquote collusion directly related to her efforts to raise concerns about Dr. Gottlieb. And Ms. Drennan's only explanation for what she meant by collusion was that Dr. Finch was engaging in a fraudulent or illegal conspiracy related to her efforts to raise concerns about Dr. Gottlieb. This is clear, direct evidence showing the mindset of Allina executives and that they had drawn a negative opinion of Dr. Finch directly from her protected conduct. Those are just a few of the facts in the record here, but I want to move on to the legal error in the district court's opinion. And that is primarily related to the district court improperly weighing evidence. And that is clearly a factor throughout the district court's opinion. Now, the district court uses the vocabulary of the sufficiency of evidence rather than expressly making credibility determinations. But this court need look no further than the function of the sufficiency test adopted by the district court as used here to understand what was occurring, which were improper credibility determinations. In addition to the sufficiency test, the district court adopted both a substantial evidence standard and a standard that you have to raise quote unquote concrete objections to the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Now, my understanding is that neither of those standards have ever been adopted by Minnesota courts as to reprisal or the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And the district court's repeated use of substantial evidence, which it draws from the DLH case, a Minnesota Supreme Court case, which is not a Minnesota Human Rights Act case, shows the district court's error, because substantial evidence as used in DLH is not a reference to the amount of evidence. The DLH court expressly rejected that the phrase substantive evidence or substantial evidence, pardon me, is tied to the quote unquote quantum of evidence. What the Minnesota Supreme Court was referring to is whether the evidence was substantive. And again, the Minnesota Supreme Court has expressly rejected that there's questions the amount of evidence. But the district court clearly used the substantial evidence phrase lifted from DLH to refer to the amount of evidence. And this court—
Counsel, I appreciate your argument. I see that you're coming up on about 5 minutes left in time, and I have some questions about the negligence action. Yes, can I turn your attention to that issue, please?
Of course.
All right. So in this case, Dr. Finch is an employee of Allina, correct?
Yes.
And it seems to me, based on the pleading, that the duties that Allina owes to Dr. Finch arise out of the employment relationship. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are there any other duties that Allina owes to Dr. Finch separate and apart from the duties that originate from the employment relationship?
Your Honor, the relationship is from her employment relationship, but I do think that, as we highlight in the reply brief, that that employment relationship includes a special relationship that means that Dr. Finch had to be protected against violations of public policy and also against physical harm or the threat of physical harm, Your Honor.
And the reason that the relationship is special is because she's an employee, is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so is it correct, and I'm going back to your original brief, which was before the Able decision was announced by the Minnesota Supreme Court, that the negligence claim is essentially an alternative to the Minnesota Human Rights Act claim. Is that right? It's alternative pleading.
I would say it's parallel. And you know, as we addressed in the Able case, that I think a lot of the preemption analysis here in prior cases has gotten sucked into what's really an election of remedies argument. And what the Minnesota Supreme Court said in Able is that until a court determines that the Minnesota Human Rights Act applies, preemption is a moot issue.
And but you would agree, though, that Able is in a different position than your client because she wasn't an employee, right?
Well, I think the facts are different, but not the law as adopted by the Minnesota Supreme Court, which is
Why not?
Because the question is whether I think, Your Honor, as you were asking about, you know, alternative pleading, and as the Minnesota Supreme Court said, preemption cannot be answered until a court determines whether the Minnesota Human Rights Act applies. And here, for instance,
unless there's no question that the Minnesota Human Rights Act applies. I mean, in Able, there was a question as to whether it applies, right? Because she was an unpaid practicum student.
But here, both Allina and the district court have concluded that Dr. Finch has no remedy under the Minnesota Human Rights Act.
That's a different question. Whether she has an available remedy is a different question than whether the act applies. There's no dispute that the act applies, right?
I guess I would just respectfully disagree that that's a distinction without a difference, Your Honor. Having a remedy is concurrent with whether there is whether the act applies would be my position. If you have a remedy under the act, then the act does not apply. This would be my position.
Is there some authority for that?
I'd point to Able. That the source of the remedy, the ability to invoke the protections of the Minnesota Human Rights Act is the question about whether it applies. And that was the issue in Able. And they said, until you have protection under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, it does not prevent, any other concurrent claim.
Okay. And just I
was just going to say, well, what Abel says is at this early stage in the litigation, we cannot definitively say that the duties owed under the common law are the same as the statutory obligations to Abel. And the court couldn't say that because there was still a totality of circumstances test to be applied to Abel as to whether, in fact, she was an employee. I think that is what has to happen in that case, is it has to be determined, as I read it, that she's an employee and that there are, and what the duties, and then if the duties are owed to her, one could read this as saying, if the duties are owed to her under the Human Rights Act as an employee, then and the duties are the same in the common law. I think it's an opposite conclusion. One could read that. I think that since no question there are duties owed to an employee under the Human Rights Act, there's nothing yet left for the court to determine about what duties are owed to Dr. Finch. She's clearly an employee. I don't see him talking about remedies at all. I don't see it as saying, well, if you lose your Human Rights Act claim, you get to bring the same thing under the same obligations and duties under the common law.
I just want to be distinct that our position is not that the Human Rights Act imposed the duty. And I would point to the Vaughn opinion, which was a predecessor, which the Supreme Court relied on for Abel, which related to disability claims. And it said that the Human Rights Act does not extinguish a common law disability claim merely because you also have a remedy under the Human Rights Act. And violation of a common law duty is a distinct legal injury from violation of the Human Rights Act, and that you can have both a common law injury and an injury arising from the same facts under the Human Rights Act. And that's the Vaughn opinion, which predates Abel.
All right.
I see my time's up. I'm happy to answer any other questions the court has.
Anything else from the panel? All right, Mr. Pelican, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I am Jack Sullivan, counsel for respondent Allina Health System. I'd like to begin where the last argument ended, with the negligence preemption that clearly justifies the district court's dismissal of Dr. Finch's sexual harassment claim. As two members of this panel decided in 2017, Judge Smith and Judge Hooten in the Bray versus Starbucks case, when a MHRA claim and a negligence claim arise from the same facts and from the same underlying conduct, then there is no daylight between the Minnesota Human Rights Act claim and the negligence claim such that the negligence claim is preempted.
Can you square that with Vaughn? Can you talk about the Vaughn case and how that principle squares with that?
So Vaughn related to different duties than the Minnesota Human Rights Act duties. So the MHRA duties in Vaughn, as I recall, were the protections against discrimination on the basis of disability. The common law duty that was owed was a common law duty to protect passengers for a common carrier. So it was Northwest Airlines. It had a duty to its customers under the Minnesota Human Rights Act to not discriminate against them on the basis of disability. It also had a common law duty that was separate and apart from that duty because it was a common carrier. Here we have an employer. There's no question that Dr. Finch was employed by Allina, and that her complaints are allegedly that she was subjected to sexual harassment and exposed to discrimination and violations that are only violations of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. There is no common law duty to protect a person from sexual harassment. And I wanted to pick up on the Abel case because obviously, as Mr. Pelican is, I'm familiar with that case, having litigated it in conjunction with this case is not able for the very reasons that Your Honor Judge Frisch mentioned. Megan Abel was an unpaid practicum, a participant in an unpaid practicum. What the Supreme Court determined in with regard to her is that, number one, it's an open question as to whether she, as an unpaid practicum participant, is able to bring a Minnesota Human Rights Act employment claim against Allina. The court didn't say that she can. They said it's an open question and there'll be an employment test that's applied to that in as that case goes forward. The court then said, until that determination is made, we are not going to say whether her claim is preempted. The determination has been made whether an employee, such as Dr. Finch, may bring a claim against her employer, ALINA. That's the Minnesota Human Rights Act. So there really is, because there is no daylight whatsoever between the negligence claim and the Minnesota Human Rights Act claim, the negligence claim is preempted by the Minnesota Human Rights Act. I'd like to take a step back and turn to the reprisal claim that was dismissed on summary judgment. And advocates and the court were used to going through the elements of the claim in the sequence that we're used to, that there's protected conduct and adverse employment action, and is there causation between the two? In this case, I think it's more helpful to think of the elements a bit differently and to simply ask, did anything bad happen to appellant? Is there a genuine issue of material fact that she experienced an adverse employment action? If the answer to that...
How do you get... Let's turn to the one that we've already talked about. It would be an exercise in humiliation for you to apply for the training director position. And that's said by someone who at that time apparently had a role in... or was going to have a role, it appeared, or had some role in hiring that position, although I think maybe Dr. Schmitz ultimately left. I might be wrong about that. But how do you overcome a factual dispute over that? I mean, that was discouragement from applying, you know, taking it at face value and all inferences in favor of the non-moving party. That's discouragement from applying for the position.
What the district court correctly concluded was that evidentiary, that piece of evidence does not have probative value. It is not a piece of evidence from which reasonable persons could draw the conclusion that Dr. Finch sustained an adverse employment action. And that's because the evidence is taken with all of the other evidence at summary judgment. There's a clear distinction between weighing evidence and evaluating evidence for its legal sufficiency. So as appellant's counsel noted, Judge Robin referred to substantial evidence throughout his opinion. Those are not his words. They're the words of the Minnesota Supreme Court from the Murphy versus Country House case, which makes it clear that substantial evidence refers to legal sufficiency, not quantum.
Why is it? I mean, it seems to me like he took it from the jury's hands by saying that it's not reasonable to conclude that when your supervisor or a decision maker says, don't apply for this job, because if you do, it's going to be a humiliating experience for you. Why a reasonable person who receives that and then doesn't apply for the job because they don't want to be humiliated ostensibly, why isn't that a question of fact that the jury gets to decide? Why isn't that enough?
Because it's not the only evidence of what Dr. Finch says happened in August of 2016. Dr. Finch submitted a sworn statement to the Minnesota Department of Human Rights to support her charge of discrimination. At no point in that does she refer to any intimidation on the part of Dr. Schmitz. What she says is she was promised a job, she didn't get it without explanation. It's a sworn statement from Dr. Finch.
But aren't you, in effect, though, asking you were asking the district court to weigh that evidence and to make basically credibility calls as to which statement that Dr. Finch made do you believe? And I mean, why do we as a reviewing court and taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the moving party here, why can we weigh that evidence? Why can the district court and also this court weigh that evidence?
Thank you, Your Honor. It's not weighing the evidence. Elina is not asking this court and did not ask the district court to weigh that evidence, to put Dr. Finch's statement over here on one side of the scales and other evidence over here and see where the scales balance. What Elina argued and the district court found was that that statement did not have probative value. The district court cited to the Ulseldinger and Sons case from the Minnesota Supreme Court, which makes it clear that deposition testimony must have foundation other than conjecture to be a basis of a summary judgment determination. And the district court considered that law, applied it to the facts that were before it and the evidence that was before it, and determined that there was no genuine issue of material fact related to from which a reasonable jury could draw the determination that an adverse employment action occurred.
Why is it conjecture when she says, I didn't apply for the job because I didn't want this threat or this intimidating comment to become a reality? That's because her direct evidence. It's her statement.
That's her statement, but she has other statements. So on September 8th, a friend of hers, Tina Welke, wrote a Facebook message to Dr. Finch and said, but you didn't want to be the training director, though. What do you want to do? Dr. Finch said, I don't know. She didn't say, well, I wanted to, but Mike Schmitz barred me from doing it. I was intimidated from applying for that. So that is also evidence that was in the record. And if
it,
I may,
it just seems, counsel, that we're picking and choosing which evidence has more value or should be accorded greater weight among all of the evidence. And the standard here is there, when we take the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, which is Dr. Finch, that we should be according even more weight to what she says than the other evidence that is credited in the record.
Your Honor, then I would step back to the framework that I had mentioned. If there is a genuine issue of material fact that there was an adverse employment action, then that isn't the end of the analysis. The court must ask, are there genuine issues of material fact that any adverse employment action was caused by the plaintiff participating in protected conduct? And those three dots must be connected in order for a appellant, in this case, to win the reversal of summary judgment. The picture must be connected to show a genuine issue of material fact such that the reprisal claim should go forward. There is no evidence that Dr. Schmitz knew anything about the June 15th meeting that Dr. Finch had with Dr. Gehring and Hillary Crothers. So even setting aside whether that was protected conduct, which we assert there is no genuine issue of material fact and that that was not protected conduct, there is no evidence of causation. Because you have a meeting that occurred on June 15th. You have a statement that Dr. Finch says was made at some point in August. And you have conjecture, pure conjecture in her declaration that Mike Schmitz must have known about that meeting.
Could he have not? What about the other protected conduct that unquestionably existed? And here I think we get to the interesting thing about what a plaintiff has to bring forward to make a prime of, you know, to satisfy, to have the sufficient evidence to meet the burden, because there was protected conduct, clearly. Dr. Schmitz knew about her earlier complaints, I assume. Not the meeting, but the earlier ones. And sometimes timing is evidence of causation. I don't know that the absence of timing is necessarily evidence. I mean, I guess it could be that there, I mean, usually when it's far apart, there's usually some good things in between or something. I'm trying to figure out, like, even if it's not that meeting in June, isn't there, you know, isn't there enough? Especially if there's an allegation that she, by Dr. Finch, that she was mistreated sort of along the way and treated hostily along the way.
Thank you, Your Honor. There are four acts that Elina took the position at summary judgment that that would constitute protected conduct. So there's a December 2015 complaint, there's a January 2016 submission to the Board of Psychology, there is the filing of the charge, which happened after the incidents that we're talking about. And then there's the filing of this litigation in and of itself. So there is nothing that connects the January Board of Psychology complaint or the December 2015 complaint to that August event. There are intervening events, such as Dr. Schmidt's submitting Dr. Finch and awarding her a $3,000 bonus as a key contributor, identifying her as a viable internal candidate for the training director position. So there is no evidence that the two things had anything to do with each other. So there's protected conduct over here, and then there's an event that Dr. Finch alleges was an adverse employment action, and there is no connection between the two other than conjecture. The statements in her declaration that it was in this context that Mike Schmitz told me not to do this. If that is even, you know, like, again, that had no probative value in the view of the district court, given all of the other evidence that was in the record. But here, I would say there is no evidence that would link any of those pieces of protected conduct to that specific event. And I would submit that the connection has to be specific. It can't just be, there was protected conduct and there was an adverse employment action, so something must connect the two. It has to be, you did this and then this happened to you because you did that. I note that I'm coming close to the end of my time. I will end by noting that Alina respectfully requests that this court affirm the dismissal of appellant's complaint. The summary judgment was properly granted, and Alina's motion to dismiss was properly granted.
Thank you very much, counsel. Anything else from the panel? Okay. Thank you. Mr. Pelican?
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Just a few quick points related to what Mr. Sullivan was discussing in the court's questions. First, on the Usseldinger case and the notion of conjecture, if you go to that case and you look at what the conjecture was, it was an insurance coverage case about how ring rot had gotten from infected some plants. And the only direct testimony in that case was, well, maybe it was on the machines, maybe it was on the truck, we don't know. And so what the court said is, there's no fact testimony here that supports the causal connection. It's only speculation. Here, what the district court was discounting and what Mr. Sullivan is asking this court to discount is direct factual statements. Dr. Schmitz told me X, and he told me X because of Y.
So can you tell us, apropos of that, if we were to agree that the statement in August, I guess, about don't apply for this job was an adverse employment action, and if we were also to agree, not with you, but with Alina, that the meeting in June was not the protected conduct, or July, but rather the protected conduct was the earlier board complaint and complaint internally, what connects the December-January protected conduct with that August statement?
Dr. Finch had universally sterling performance reviews. The only negative words, or some of the only negative words about Dr. Finch in the entire factual record, are Dr. Schmitz's statement in an August email that she is anxious around coworkers and triangulates. And we have direct testimony from Ms. Carruthers and Dr. Gearing, who said that he, by the way, there was a question about whether Dr. Schmitz knew about that June meeting. And Dr. Gearing testified on pages 101 and 102 of his deposition that he went from that June meeting back to Dr. Schmitz and said, Kim is triangulating against you. And then Dr. Schmitz turned around and used the same phrase, triangulating, in an email to Ms. Carruthers. That's one of the only negative things about Dr. Finch's conduct. And now I understand your question on the June meeting, and I'll come back to that. And that's why I go to something like Ms. Drennan's email accusing Dr. Finch of, in her own words, fraudulent or illegal conspiracy directly related, in her own words, to Dr. Finch's efforts to raise concerns about Dr. Gottlieb. The only negative statements about Dr. Finch in the entire record are expressly linked in those written communications themselves to her efforts to raise concerns about Dr. Gottlieb. That's the triangulation email. It's the collusion email. And then you have, you know, after the fact, Ms. Carruthers saying that she's dramatic and Dr. Finch's supervisors saying, managers at Allina don't like you. And this is Dr. Lund, and testifying between Dr. Lund and Ms. Carruthers under oath that the only reason they had a negative opinion of Dr. Finch was because of her efforts to raise concerns about Dr. Gottlieb. Dr. Lund said he had hired—
And what ties those with Schmitz? I'm trying to, like, since the statement was by Dr. Schmitz, is it?
Dr. Schmitz.
Schmitz. And you're talking about other— I'm just trying to link again that statement back to the protected conduct vis-a-vis him.
It's Dr. Finch's testimony that he warned her, that he made repeated comments about, you know, keep your mouth shut, don't speak about this. And back to related to one of the questions that you had asked, the panel had asked earlier, about whether Dr. Finch spoke about Dr. Gottlieb at that meeting. And she testifies in her deposition, and Ms. Carruthers testified, that in the email correspondence setting up the June meeting, Dr. Finch had said, I want to meet with you to raise my concerns about Dr. Schmitz and Dr. Gottlieb. And so you do have this record of Dr. Finch trying to get help for her, what she viewed as Dr. Schmitz's adverse actions against her. And I would just like to conclude by saying that, you know, Mr. Sullivan used the phrase evaluating evidence. And I think the panel put it exactly correctly. The district court said, well, Dr. Finch testified to A, but she also testified to B. We tend to believe B. You know, I've heard Dr. Finch testify. She said, this happened to me. And this is what I believe. I wanted that job. I would have worked more. And the district court did not have the benefit of that testimony, but that's not its role. And Dr. Finch is not here. She was not at the district court. But for purposes of reviewing the summary judgment order, this court must credit her testimony as true. And taken as true, that is enough to create a material fact here. She's entitled to her day in court based on her testimony.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Anything else from the panel this morning or this afternoon? All right. The matter is submitted. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue an order within the statutory time period.